Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We've got some Taylor Swift news, we've got royal news, and we've got lots of politics. So let's get started. Our first headline is about Taylor Swift. Travis Kelce is just as surprised as you are that he got Taylor Swift to date him. This is by Casey Wickman, published on April 11th. It all started with a friendship bracelet and a light roasting. The rest, as we could see from the way Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce dominate the headlines every time they go out, is celebrity relationship history. On Tuesday evening, Swift and Kelce tried, keyword tried, to escape notice when they stepped out for a date night at Los Angeles's Bird Street Club. The duo attempted to thwart the waiting lenses by ducking down in the backseat of the vehicle they were riding in, to limited success. Earlier in the evening, the car was spotted with a white sheet tacked up between the front and back seats in sort of a makeshift privacy barrier, though the conspicuous attempt at privacy may have attracted more attention than it diverted. An onlooker at the restaurant told Page Six that Swift and Kelce, who went public with their relationship in September 2023 after getting to know one another in secret, looked stylish and happy at the restaurant. They were low-key, very tall, the source said. They were with two other people. Indeed, on the latest episode of New Heights podcast that he co-hosts with brother Jason Kelce, released Wednesday, Travis confided in guest Lil Dicky after the topic of Swift bubbled up. That is, he is happy. "I'm having a blast in life, baby," Travis said on the pod. "Just flying high, enjoying it all, bringing new lives to the football world." The 36-year-old rapper seemed just as enchanted by the romance between Swift and Kansas City Chiefs tight end as civilian onlookers, giddily describing the dynamics between the two. "The world is kind of like high school, where your most popular pop star, beloved musician, somehow met your most popular, beloved athlete, and they actually fell in love and it's real," Lil Dicky said. "I don't know. I think anyone who hates on it is like a bitter loser. But I think a lot of people you know would maybe expect to hate on it actually love it, and they acknowledge they love it because there's something so American about it. So there, dads, brads, and chads." "I appreciate that," Travis responded, with Lil Dicky adding that there's something just classic about it. Travis admitted, laughing, that when it comes to his origin story with Swift, "I don't know how I did it. She wasn't into sports," he said, "so I don't know how the fuck I did it. Emotionally, that is." He laughed that, "I know exactly how I did it in terms of the details, the public version of which are etched into public consciousness." Travis attended Swift's Eras Tour show in Kansas City in July 2023 and showed up with a friendship bracelet with his phone number emblazoned in beads, hoping to meet the singer and gift it to her. Cute, but it didn't work, at least not in the way he'd hoped. "She doesn't meet anybody, or at least she didn't want to meet me, so I took it personal," he said on a late-night episode of New Heights. "But it was an unbelievable show. The squeaky wheel gets the grease, and the rebuffed Super Bowl winner who genially complains about it to his brother on his very popular podcast gets the internationally renowned billionaire pop star, it would appear." In her Time Person of the Year profile, Swift saluted Travis for his determination in making his way into her heart, saying he got her attention when he very adorably put me on blast on his podcast, which I thought was metal as hell. And the two started secretly hanging out shortly after, going public in September when Swift attended one a Chiefs game, then literally drove off into the sunset with Travis after. "Ballsy," Travis called it on the podcast later that week. "She may not have been into sports back then, but now," Swift says, "football is awesome, it turns out. She's been to more than a dozen games in the last year, including the Super Bowl, and has the bedazzled purse to match. My, how times have changed." Our next Taylor Swift story, revisiting Clara Bow, the scrutinized it girl who inspired Taylor Swift's new song. This is by Savannah Walsh, published on April 12th. What could silent film star Clara Bow, who has been called the tormented Hollywood outsider, have in common with Taylor Swift? That's the question we've been asking since Swift unveiled the track list for her forthcoming album, The Tortured Poets Department. The final song is titled Clara Bow. Swift, whose 11th studio album debuts April 19th, has been known to reference real-life figures in her lyrics, from tumultuous old Hollywood couple Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton in Ready for It, To accentuate socialite Rebecca Harkness, who lived in the Rhode Island mansion now owned by Swift in The Last Great American Dynasty, Beau's family only learned that their relative would be on the latest Swiftian subject after she announced the album on stage as part of her acceptance speech for Best Pop Vocal Album at the Grammys 2024. We could not believe it. We were shocked, and then the intrigue set in because no one from our family has been contacted or knew about this prior, Nicole Cisneros, one of Beau's great-granddaughters, told People magazine. Cisneros said she reached out to Swift's team asking what prompted the track and where the connection is coming from, but has yet to hear back. Cisneros and another one of Beau's other great-granddaughters, Brittany Grace Bell, hope that the song encapsulates their late great-grandmother's perseverance. As Bell explained, she came from a really tough background, and she really made it happen for herself. I hope she conveys a positive image of Clara Beau, which I think she will. I would imagine that Taylor uses this as a way to highlight her accomplishments, her accolades, her talent. They're both people that have really strong, raw talent. Bell also noted that Beau and Swift are both pioneers in their field and ventured that Clara Beau would feel the same kinship and protectiveness over someone who's of the same level of fame as her in dealing with the media and how heavy the crown is to carry. The Brooklyn-born Beau grew up in the most brutal poverty that was known at the time. David Sten, author of 1988's Clara Beau, Runnin' Wild, previously told the BBC. Beau found a ticket out of her turbulent childhood, ruled by an abusive father and mother who was diagnosed with psychosis due to epilepsy when she submitted her photo to a Fame and Fortune magazine competition in 1921 at age 16. After taking the top prize, Beau began appearing in films, making 57 movies in a decade, 46 silent, and 11 talkies. In any other era, said Judith Mackerel, author of Flappers, Six Women of a Dangerous Generation, she would have ended up on the streets or in a factory, but the existence of cinema as a mass industry gave her the chance to reinvent her life. Beau would appear in many successful films, including 1926's Man Trap, 1927's Wings, which became the first Oscar winner for Best Picture, and 1929's The Wild Party, her first talkie. But it was 1927's It, an adaptation of the Eleanor Glynn novella in which Beau plays Betty Lou, a shop girl who dreams of romancing her employer, that gave the star her It Girl branding. She was the first American sex symbol, Sten said, per the Washington Post. Women wanted to be her and men wanted to be with her. She had a warmth and vulnerability that was appealing to everyone. Beau cultivated what some may now call a parasocial relationship with her most ardent fans. She really came alive in front of the camera, Mackerel told the BBC. When you watch her, you feel as if she's doing something very spontaneous for you. So you're having a relationship with her. That may be an illusion, but it's a very powerful one. But the pressures of fame haunted Beau at the heights of her powers. The studios were working her to death, added Elaine Shepherd, who produced a BBC 4 documentary on Beau in 2012. She was on heaps of primitive pills to get her out of bed in the morning and to get her to sleep at night. Executives were trying to exploit her as much as possible. Gossip magazines were writing the most awful lies about her, and she was dealing with all that on her own as a woman in her 20s. She just found it way too stressful. Beau's anxieties were only exacerbated by rumors about her scandalous personal life. As an ideal subject for the devices of press agents, Miss Beau was given a background of constant romance and many broken engagements, Beau's eventual New York Times obituary read. At least 7 men prominent in the film industry or in business were reputed to be her suitors simultaneously, her Man-Trap director Victor Fleming and actor Gary Cooper reportedly among them. She wasn't well-liked amongst other women in the film colony, fellow silent film actor Lena Basquet once said, according to The Guardian. Her social presence was taboo, and it was rather silly because God knows Marion Davies and Mary Pickford had plenty to hide. It's just that they hid it, and Clara didn't. Beau made her final film, 1933's Hoopla, at the age of 28, telling press at the time, "I want to be known as a serious actress, not as an it girl." At age 28, Swift was also retreating from public life following the fallout from Kanye West's Famous and a video Kim Kardashian posted that appeared to show Swift signing off on a lyric in which the rapper referred to her as a bitch. Speaking to Time in 2023, Swift said that the incident took me down psychologically to a place I've never been before, adding, I moved to a foreign country. I didn't leave a rental house for a year. I was afraid to get on phone calls. I pushed away most people in my life because I didn't trust anyone anymore. I went down really, really hard. I thought that moment of backlash was going to define me negatively for the rest of my life. Instead, Swift reemerged with her Reputation era and later went on to re-record her music catalog after the masters were purchased by Scooter Braun, West's former manager. Bo wasn't afforded the same redemption arc. Clara was not in the position to do that, film historian Leonard Maltin previously told the Los Angeles Times of mounting a comeback. Not that others didn't. Mary Pickford certainly did. She completely controlled her career. But Clara was uneducated and didn't have a lot of confidence in herself. She was sort of a victim waiting to be victimized in a sense. Shortly before quitting show business, Bo married actor Rex Bell, whom she met on the set of their 1930 movie, True to the Navy. They welcomed two children and lived on their Nevada ranch until Bell died of a heart attack in 1962. Just 3 years later, Bo died of a heart attack herself at age 60 in Los Angeles, as reported by the New York Times. Bo's legacy has permeated pop culture long before Swift picked up her pen. She gets imitated by Liza Minnelli in Cabaret, emulated in the Betty Boop cartoon, and served as an inspiration for Margot Robbie's character in Babylon. Her namesake song also coincides with the release of a long-lost Bo film, the 1923's The Pill Pounder, which was discovered in October at the bottom of a box of auctioned reels that sold for $20 in Omaha and premiered at the 27th Annual San Francisco Silent Film Festival. Maybe it was the It Girl label or withdrawal from public life that inspired Swift to write about Bo. Then again, the Grammy winner may have long been hitting for her fixation on the silent film star. In her Reputation track, Gorgeous, Swift sings, Whiskey on ice, sunset and vine, you've ruined my life by not being mine. As fate would have it, that's the same corner on which Bo's Hollywood Walk of Fame star currently resides. Next up in Hollywood, White House black tie. Robert De Niro and Tiffany Chen have a White House state dinner date night. This is by Casey Wickman, published on April 11th. Robert De Niro and girlfriend Tiffany Chen, who recently marked the first birthday of their daughter Gia, stepped out for a date night Wednesday evening at an extraordinary venue, the White House. The two were guests at a state dinner hosted by President Joe Biden and First Lady Dr. Jill Biden in honor of Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and his wife Yuko Kishida. Chen, 45, wore a white floor-length gown, black heels, and an off-white shawl with black trim, while De Niro, 80, opted for a classic black tuxedo, white shirt, and wide black necktie. The couple were photographed holding hands and smiling as they entered the event, which was decorated with fan and koi pond imagery. The featured blooms native to both the United States and Japan, as well as a spring-themed menu with dishes from both. They weren't the only prominent couple to wine and dine with the Bidens. Jeff Bezos and fiancée Lauren Sanchez also donned their black tie finery for the event. Bezos, too, wore a black tux, though he paired it with a black silk bow tie. Sanchez turned heads at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in a crimson gown by Rosario, which featured a red lace corset-style bodice and a silk floor-length skirt. Around 200 guests filled out the roster for Wednesday's dinner, including government dignitaries and prominent figures, such as Japanese-American Olympic figure skating gold medalist Christy Yamaguchi, Apple CEO Tim Cook, former President Bill Clinton, and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and more. Paul Simon pulled double duty, acting as both attendee and entertainment. The Bridge Over Troubled Water musician performed during the reception. Moving into a little royal news, this headline, Prince William and Kate Middleton break silence with Sydney stabbing statement. This is by Eve Beattie, published on April 13th. A mass slaying in a Sydney, Australia mall has prompted Prince William and wife Kate Middleton to release their first public statement in weeks. The couple, which has remained silent since Middleton revealed her cancer diagnosis in March, took to Instagram on Saturday to express their shock at today's stabbing spree at the Westfield Bondi Junction Mall. Seven people were killed in the onslaught, and eight more have been hospitalized, Reuters reports, including a 9-month-old baby. According to the New York Times, a single suspect was behind the attack, which began around 4 p.m. local time Saturday. A witness who spoke with Reuters said the suspect was just running around with his knife. Another described the man, who was reportedly dressed in an Australian National Rugby League jersey and shorts, as on a killing spree and said he had a nice big blade on him. A sole female police officer who was directed to the suspect by a fleeing crowd at the mall ran toward him, New South Wales Police Assistant Commissioner Anthony Cook said at a press conference. According to Cook, when the suspect lunged at the officer with his weapon, she opened fire and then went over and was giving him CPR, a witness told Reuters. If she did not shoot him, he would have kept going. He was on the rampage, the witness said. The alleged assailant, who has not been publicly named, died as a result of the shooting. According to the New South Wales Police, he was a 40-year-old man who police believe was acting randomly. There's no suggestion there was anyone targeted, New South Wales Police Commissioner Karen Webb said at a press conference. Investigators don't have fears for that person holding an ideation, Webb said. In other words, it's not a terrorism incident. Via their Instagram account, William and Middleton posted to the platform's stories function, saying, "We are shocked and saddened by the terrible events in Sydney earlier today. Our thoughts are with all of those affected, including the loved ones of those lost and the heroic emergency responders who risked their own lives to save others." The post, which will disappear from the platform 24 hours after posting, continued, "It was signed W&C." The post marks the first public remarks from the royal couple since their joint statement following Middleton's March 22nd video explaining her months-long absence from royal duties following surgery in January. Tests after the operation found cancer had been present, Middleton said in March, necessitating a course of preventative chemotherapy. As a result, the family stepped away from royal duties, including the traditional family gathering on Easter Sunday, opting to spend their children's Easter holiday break in Windsor. Sources close to the family suggest that after their children, Prince George, Princess Charlotte, and Prince Louis, returned to school on April 17th, the couple might slowly resume public life. King Charles III, who himself has recently reemerged to public view after cancer treatments of his own, also released a statement Saturday regarding the attack. "My wife and I were utterly shocked and horrified to hear of the tragic stabbing incident in Bondi," he said in a statement. "Our hearts go out to the families and loved ones of those who have been so brutally killed during such a senseless act. While details of these shocking circumstances are still emerging, our thoughts are also with those who were involved in the response, and we give thanks for the bravery of the first responders and emergency services." Australia is a constitutional monarchy that's ostensibly led by Charles, who last visited the country in 2018. At the time, he visited as a representative of Queen Elizabeth II and then considered Australia's head of state. According to Charles's nephew, Peter Phillips, who was in Australia last month, the royal family has a huge affinity for Australia, as all of us have friends over there. Other Hollywood news. J.K. Rowling takes shots at Daniel Radcliffe and Emma Watson for their commitment to trans rights. This is by Chris Murphy, published on April 11th. J.K. Rowling is quadrupling down on her anti-trans rhetoric and involving Harry Potter stars Daniel Radcliffe and Emma Watson. The author took to social media to decry a new study on gender identity services for youth, and while doing so took aim at celebrity mouthpieces who, Rowling believes, cozied up to a movement intent on eroding women's hard-won rights. Earlier this week, pediatrician Hilary Cass published a new independent review commissioned by Britain's National Health Service, NHS, of gender identity services for children and young people under 18. Cass's review found that children have been let down by the lack of research and remarkably weak evidence on medical interventions in gender care. The study also found that healthcare providers and patients have no good evidence on the long-term outcomes of interventions to manage gender-related distress and maintain that children and young people using gender care services deserve the highest standards of care and research, which are expected elsewhere in the NHS. The report inspired Rowling to post on X. In a thread, Rowling highlighted Cass's report as the most robust review of the medical evidence for transitioning children that's ever been conducted, but used the report to justify her own position on the harms of gender-affirming care for children. If I sound angry, it's because I'm bloody angry, Rowling posted. I read Cass this morning and my anger's been mounting all day. Kids have been irreversibly harmed and thousands are complicit, not just medics, but the celebrity mouthpieces, unquestioning media, and cynical corporations. In reality, Cass's review is more objective than Rowling's impassioned response suggests. Per NHS policy, children ages 16 and older have the option to receive gender-affirming hormones. The Cass review recommends extreme caution to youth considering that option and makes no mention of the irreversible harm Rowling speaks of. There should be a clear clinical rationale for providing hormones at this stage rather than waiting until an individual reaches 18, reads the review. Every case considered for medical treatment should be discussed at a national multidisciplinary team, MDT. The review also highlights the toxic nature of the debate surrounding gender-affirming care in youth and the toll it takes on children. What's unfortunately happened for these young people is that because of the toxicity of the debate, they've often been bypassed by local services who've been really nervous about seeing them, Cass told the BBC. Despite this point, Rowling continued to contribute to the toxicity by taking aim at Harry Potter stars Daniel Radcliffe and Emma Watson for their support of trans rights. Just waiting for Dan and Emma to give you a very public apology, safe in the knowledge that you will forgive them, responded ex-user at St. Austwell Adam to Rowling's thread. Not safe, I'm afraid, responded Rowling. Celebs who cozied up to the movement intent on eroding women's hard-won rights and who use their platforms to cheer on the transitioning of minors can save their apologies for traumatized detransitioners and vulnerable women reliant on single-sex spaces. Radcliffe and Watson have been steadfast in their support of trans rights. In 2020, Radcliffe wrote a blog post for the LGBTQ+ advocacy group, The Trevor Project, directly calling out Rowling in the process. Transgender women are women, wrote Radcliffe. Any statement to the contrary erases the identity and dignity of transgender people and goes against all medical advice given by professional healthcare associations who have far more expertise on the subject matter than either Rowling or I. That same year, Watson took to Twitter to express her support for the transgender community. Trans people who are who they say they are and deserve to live their lives without being constantly questioned or told they aren't who they say they are, she wrote. I want my trans followers to know that I and so many other people around the world see you, respect you, and love you for who you are. And a quick article from Inside the Hive, The Caitlin Clark Effect. ESPN reporter Alexa Philippou and Vanity Fair contributing editor Tom Klutt explain why you really can't ignore women's basketball anymore. This is by Brian Stelter, published on April 11th. With ratings showing that about 19 million viewers tuned in for this year's women's college basketball finals, women's basketball's popularity is undeniable. As ESPN reporter Alexa Philippou puts it, the sport is impossible to ignore, especially when comparing its viewership to other sports. On this week's Inside the Hive, host Brian Stelter is joined by Philippou and Vanity Fair contributing editor Tom Klutt to examine a sport seemingly at an inflection point and surging in interest at both the college and pro levels. When I think back to the Final Four last year in Dallas, that really felt like someone hit a button that was exponential growth, Philippou recounts, and it's really seemed to be noticeably different since then. The group discusses women's college stars who have helped drive enthusiasm for the game and become household names in a way that hasn't happened on the men's side, citing the rise of Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese, not to mention coach Dawn Staley. Previously, college athletes couldn't capitalize or profit off their name, image, or likeness. When the NCAA ended that policy almost 3 years ago, it really changed the landscape of college sports. We saw women's stars everywhere last season, as Clark landed deals with Nike, Gatorade, and State Farm. The group also reflects on challenges inside women's basketball and women's sports more broadly, particularly with how record viewership still hasn't led to parity in TV money. The disparity was well documented, says Klutt, but again, you see data points and metrics showing that not only can the women's game compete with the men's game, it actually eclipses it. The WNBA draft is Monday, a critical moment for the league. The Indiana Fever is expected to draft Caitlin Clark with the number one overall pick, and Klett notes that she could easily be a galvanizing force. Last fall's WNBA finals between the New York Liberty and the Las Vegas Aces felt like a cultural shift, says Klett, citing the celebrities' courtside at games, including LeBron James. And so now, you throw in someone like Caitlin Clark, who's already a household name, who's not only the biggest women's college basketball star we've seen in generations, she's really, truly one of the biggest collegiate stars, period, we've seen in years. And to round out the celebrity category, the Golden Bachelor couple announces divorce after the shortest marriage in franchise history. This is by Savannah Walsh, published on April 12th. Gold doesn't typically rust, but the shine of the inaugural Golden Bachelor couple's marriage has eroded after only 3 months. On Friday's episode of Good Morning America, Gary Turner and Teresa Nist, who wed in front of live ABC cameras on January 4th after getting engaged on the show, announced they're divorcing. Wearing matching white outfits, Turner and Nist held hands as they declared their split, which marks the shortest marriage in Bachelor franchise history. Teresa and I have had a number of heart-to-heart conversations, and we've looked closely at our situation, our living situation, and so forth, and we've come to the conclusion mutually that it's probably time for us to dissolve our marriage, says Turner. Added Nist, we've received so much love and support from so many people who watch The Golden Bachelor, and I don't think we can tell you how many people told us that it gave them so much hope. We want none of that to change for anybody. Don't give up. Stay in it. Stay hopeful, because we are. Distance apparently played a major role in their decision. Turner lives in Indiana, while Nist is based out of New Jersey. They had plans to plant roots in New Jersey or South Carolina, but as Nist explained, we looked at home after home, but we never got to the point where we made that decision. When Turner and Nist met on The Golden Bachelor, both of them had lost their lifelong spouses and were parents to two children each. The thing that strikes me the most in our conversations, it's been how dedicated both of us are to our families, Turner said on GMA. So we look at these situations and I think we just feel like it's best for the happiness of each of us to live apart. During their interview, the couple denied that a Hollywood Reporter piece unearthing Jerry's not-so-golden past, including an allegedly messy long-term romance with a woman after his wife died, were a factor in their marital issues. I still love this person. There's no doubt in my mind I'm still in love with her. I root for her every day, Turner said, pointing to Nist, who replied, I still love him. In recent weeks, the once golden pair had been active in Bachelor Nation after being spotted at Joey Grazielli's live Bachelor finale. They filmed an episode of Celebrity Family Feud that has yet to air and spoke about their relationship on the Dear Shandy podcast. When asked by the hosts how their beliefs about love had changed with age, Turner got candid. I had a belief that at an older age that falling into a relationship like this would be easier, he began, adding, you still have to do all the work to build a relationship, and in a way, with us, that was made a little more difficult because we got married and then we started the process of knowing each other, which is backwards of what 99.9% of the people in the world do, and it's been good, but it's not a cakewalk. It remains to be seen whether the split will sour viewers on the spinoff as a whole. A season of The Golden Bachelorette is on the way, but the show's inaugural lead has yet to be named. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We just finished up in the Hollywood section, and we are moving into politics. The politics section is, of course, full of election news. We're going to start with none of this is normal. Donald Trump's 2024 bid is an anti-democratic revenge fantasy being treated like a conventional political campaign. This is by Molly Zhang Fast, published on April 8th. On Monday morning, Axios's Mike Allen blasted out his early morning email with the subject line, Scoop, Trump's retaliation plan. It seems that Republicans, after failing to find actual evidence to support their vibes-based impeachment of Joe Biden, are plotting how to prosecute the president and his family if Donald Trump returns to power. One Trump ally argued that there is precedent for a second Trump administration to investigate and prosecute the Bidens, the current federal charges against Trump, Axios reported. Let's pause for a moment from today's latest campaign scoop to make something clear. None of this is normal. None of this is how American democracy is supposed to work. Trump is not a normal candidate, despite how the media often covers him. He has autocratic ambitions, having told supporters, "I am your retribution," and has promised to be a dictator, on day one in office. Trump is a presidential candidate unlike any other, just as he was a president unlike any we had had before. We have never had a president who didn't accept the peaceful transfer of power and encouraged rioters, will be wild, to storm the U.S. Capitol. We have never had a president who was impeached twice, including for trying to incite said insurrection. We have never had a former president who faces 88 charges across four criminal cases and is scheduled to be in court next week for a hush money trial. This is also a person who is now opposed by many of the people who worked closest to him the last time around. Even former Vice President Mike Pence won't endorse Trump. The situation we're in and will be in for the next 7 months is without precedent, and there is no handbook for U.S. media outlets covering the rise of authoritarianism on its own shores. In the makeup room at 30 Rock, I joked with another MSNBC guest that we could share a cell at Guantanamo Bay. I was kidding, of course, because no one takes what Kash Patel said about jailing members of the media seriously, but why don't we? Patel told Steve Bannon on his War Room podcast that if Trump is elected in November, they will go out and find the conspirators not just in government, but in the media. Trump's allies will brush off some of his more outrageous and incendiary rhetoric as jokes, but usually that's a cover when he says something that is so wildly beyond the normal political discourse, like Russia, if you're listening, or how police should rough up suspects. But as I've argued before, the media should take Trump literally and seriously, and should go for key allies like Patel, too. Just think what Trump was capable of doing in his first term, from his family separation policy for migrants to trying to get the president of Ukraine to investigate the Biden family. He also isn't subtle. In 2015, he called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States as a candidate, and then, a week into office, enacted a travel ban targeting Muslim-majority countries. Trump has called for an expanded travel ban to include Gaza if he's elected, a vow that shouldn't be dismissed. What's become abundantly clear this election cycle is that Trump has a very dark authoritarian vision for America if he gets back into office. In March, he truthed about how Liz Cheney, a Republican who tried to hold him accountable for inciting the January 6th insurrection, should go to jail along with the rest of the unselect committee. Members of the January 6th committee are taking Trump seriously, with Democratic representatives Zoe Lofgren, telling the Los Angeles Times, if he intends to eliminate our constitutional system and start arresting his political enemies, I guess I would be on that list. One thing I did learn on the committee is to pay attention and listen to what Trump says, because he means it. Taking Trump literally and seriously doesn't mean taking him credulously. One of the truths of autocrats is that they lie. As The Economist has noted, the arsenal of deceit is highly effective at keeping malign leaders in power, which is perhaps why global democracy has been in retreat for the past decade. That's why the media needs to call a lie, and not worry if doing so appears partisan, while making clear that Trump's authoritarian agenda would mark a radical break from America as we know it. This isn't just another normal presidential race. Our next article, Trump says he plans to testify in New York trial, calls jury selection largely luck. This is by Jack McCordick, published on April 13th. Former President Donald Trump said Friday that he was absolutely planning on taking the stand in his upcoming trial in New York, where he currently faces 34 criminal counts of falsifying business records related to his $130,000 hush money payment to former adult film star Stormy Daniels before his 2016 election. "I'm testifying. I tell the truth," Trump said in response to a question from a reporter during the press conference at his Mar-a-Lago estate. I mean, all I can do is tell the truth. And the truth is that there's no case. They have no case. Reprising lines he has used about his sprawling criminal cases throughout the campaign season, Trump called the prosecution against him a scam and a witch hunt, and claimed it was evidence that the U.S. had become a third world country. The trial is set to last 6 weeks, and Trump will be required to be in court every day it's in session, which will generally be every weekday, save Wednesdays. Of course, like any promise Trump makes, his vow to testify ought to be taken with a grain of salt, as he has a history of making and then reneging on similar promises. In his civil trial in New York on business fraud charges, Trump abruptly decided not to take the witness just one day before he was supposed to. The former president was ultimately hit with a $354 million penalty in that case. Sources familiar with Trump's thinking told the New York Times that the former president will likely wait to decide whether to testify until he sees if Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg presents a compelling case. Another important factor will be whether prosecutors' cross-examine efforts are restricted by the judge overseeing the case. Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, who coordinated payment to Daniels and will likely be a central witness in the trial, told NBC on Saturday that he felt the odds of Trump actually testifying were low. The likelihood of Donald Trump being on the stand is equal to the likelihood of me waking up tomorrow and being 7'6" and playing center for the New York Knicks, Cohen said. It's not going to happen. Trump's Friday comments came as Juan Merchan, the New York County Supreme Court judge presiding over the case, slapped down yet another request from the former president to delay the trial start date. The ruling was at least the fourth case last week in which an effort by Trump's legal team to postpone the trial fell flat. The case is moving forward as scheduled, with jury selection slated to begin on Monday. In his Friday remarks, Trump said that jury selection in the case is largely luck, adding, "It depends on who you get." In the media, we'll see how this goes. Journalists prepare to cover Trump on trial. This is by Charlotte Klein, published on April 12th. It was around this time last year that reporters swarmed Lower Manhattan to cover Donald Trump's arraignment for his alleged role in the 2016 hush money payout to porn star Stephanie Clifford, aka Stormy Daniels. The first-come, first-serve approach to accessing the proceedings made for some chaos, with journalists or professional line-sitters that some outlets had hired queuing up more than 20 hours early to secure a seat in the courtroom. On Monday, a mass of media will again converge outside the Manhattan Criminal Courthouse as Trump's hush money trial, the first and likely only before the presidential election, kicks off with jury selection. But this time around will be a more orderly experience for those covering it. At least that's the hope. For months now, journalists and media lawyers have been working with court officials behind the scenes to streamline the process and make sure the press corps is getting as much access as possible to this historic trial, especially given, in accordance with New York law, video cameras will not be allowed in the courtroom. About 20 news organizations, including The Washington Post, The New York Times, CNN, ABC, and NBC, are part of a coalition represented by Jeremy Chase and Rob Balin of Davis Wright Tremaine. The lawyers, who also represented media coalitions in the cases of Harvey Weinstein and Sam Bankman-Fried, have spent the past year or so speaking with journalists and in-house counsel for the news outlets and translating their concerns. Everything from bathroom breaks and lunches to trial exhibits into actionable items to present to court administrators. In that time, the state court system hired a new director of communications, Al Baker, formerly the head of media relations for NYPD, and before that, a longtime journalist. I'm told he's empowered the press to come up with creative ideas to improve the process. One of the biggest developments is a reserved seating chart that the press worked with Baker to organize. It guarantees 58 news organizations a seat in the courtroom, so reporters won't have to camp out overnight or line up at dawn for the next 6 weeks or so. To remain on the list, the news organization needs to have at least one reporter at the trial nearly every day. Law 360 reporter Frank G. Runyon, who had been speaking for months with Baker about the best and fairest way to do this, plotted the chart after going to Justice Juan Merchan's courtroom and sketching it out in his notebook. Just to make sure that when we're talking about numbers, and Al was talking about how many seats they can fit for the press, we had common ground, common facts, Runyon told me, because you're not normally counting seats at that level. The seating chart got a dry run at a hearing on March 25th, and it was pretty painless compared to the other times, so everyone is just hoping that it will stick, said the New York Daily News courts reporter Molly Crane Newman. Still, she's holding her breath. I'll believe it when I see it. It all seems well and good and ironed out, but I don't know if they are underestimating. Maybe there'll be a surge of other reporters who are only jumping in now and will be demanding a seat in the courtroom once it all gets started. The death of O.J. Simpson this week has revived memories of another trial of the century, a murder case against a football legend that riveted the nation and fueled a media spectacle unlike any before it. The trial of a former president who has pleaded not guilty to the 34 charges against him for falsifying business records will surely be one of the most closely followed cases this generation, especially as Trump simultaneously runs for president. But whereas millions of Americans tuned in to every legal twist and turn of the Simpson trial, the lack of cameras for Trump's proceedings puts an even greater responsibility on the news media to inform the public about what's actually happening inside the courtroom. The first two or so weeks of the trial will be jury selection, when Merchan's courtroom will be packed with prospective jurors. During that time, there won't be enough room for the full press corps. Instead, the press will have a rotating pool of six reporters and sketch artist in the main courtroom, and the remaining reporters on the reserved list will be in the overflow room. Journalists have also organized among themselves to form other pools, including the TV entities, CNN, NBC, ABC, etc., who will have one station within the Penn on the 15th floor, where Merchan's courtroom is, that is operated by a different crew each week. There will also be a pool of journalists in the hallway where Trump has been known to make spontaneous utterances. If there's any case that's a good test case for pushing a good access and transparency, I feel at least that it's this one, says Mike Sisak, who covers law enforcement and courts for the Associated Press. There are other concerns aside from seating arrangements, such as access to court records. The New York State court system is a labyrinth, said Runyon, who recently wrote about the arcane and secretive nature of New York's criminal court, which does not have a digital court docket system. The official record all boils down to what ends up in a brown accordion folder in the clerk's office, Runyon told me. This is the first trial of a former president and, I believe, a current presidential candidate, and we're doing this in a way that looks like we live in the 1950s, he notes. Trial transcripts, which are not publicly available for free under the court system, are also an issue. Court stenographers own their work and have different rates depending on the turnaround time. While daily transcripts distributed the morning after a trial date have a set rate, $5.50 to $6.50 per page, immediate transcripts received the evening of the day's proceeding are less clearly priced, so Chase and Balin have negotiating with the stenographers. It seems that the court reporters have significantly more bargaining power for these types of transcripts because the rules are silent on immediate transcripts, Chase recently wrote in an email to the coalition obtained by Vanity Fair. With so many conversations going on between the coalition and court officials, between journalists outside the coalition and court officials, even the process of trying to improve the process is not very smooth, as one court reporter put it. An elaborate system has been built, and we will see how this goes. I don't know what to expect, said Runyon, but there's been an ongoing dialogue to try and get this right. And honestly, what this is really about is getting the most news out to the American voting public as fast as possible. On the one hand, it's just like any other case, any other day at court. You've got a perp, you've got a prosecutor, you've got a defense team that will do whatever they can to win. This is a story we've all written 1,000 times, and we're ready, another court reporter told me. On the other hand, it's the fucking Thunderdome. This is the first time in U.S. history that an ex-president has faced a criminal trial. This court administration has done a great job with logistics thus far, but it's still going to be a physical and mental marathon for what, 6 weeks, 2 months? Moving into a little Arizona news, Republicans are trying and failing to clean up their abortion mess. This is by Eric Lutz, published on April 12th. Republicans made their bed in Arizona, so why don't they want to lie in it? Former President Donald Trump, who has proudly taken credit for the killing of Roe v. Wade, suggested this week that Arizona's revival of a 160-year-old abortion ban went too far, even though it's a logical outgrowth of his official campaign policy that reproductive rights should be decided by individual states. Carrie Lake, the Trump acolyte running for Kyrsten Sinema's Senate seat, echoed that the 1864 law was out of step with Arizonans, despite having described the very same law as great just 2 years ago. Vulnerable GOP lawmakers in the Copper State and beyond have likewise sought to distance themselves from the statute, with Arizona Representative Juan Kiskomani calling it archaic. South Carolina Representative Nancy Mace condemning it as a draconian, and New York Representative Mark Molinaro slamming the Arizona court ruling as awful. That's all true, of course, but the GOP has only itself to blame, as Democrats have eagerly emphasized. President Joe Biden, who narrowly won Arizona in 2020 and is seeking to replicate that in what's sure to be an even tighter rematch against Trump in November, said this week that the Arizona court ruling was the result of an extreme agenda of Republican elected officials who are committed to ripping away women's freedom. His campaign quickly pounced on the law, launching an ad blitz in the key swing state that tied the Arizona ban to Trump. "Your body and your decisions belong to you, not the government, not Donald Trump," Biden says in the ad. "I will fight like hell to get your freedom back." And on Friday, Vice President Kamala Harris is taking that message directly to Arizona, where she'll make the case in Tucson that the state's forthcoming restrictions are a taste of what a second Trump term will look like. More bans, more suffering, less freedom. The overturning of Roe was a seismic event, and this ban in Arizona is one of the biggest aftershocks yet, as Harris puts it in her prepared remarks. "We all must understand who is to blame. It is the former president, Donald Trump." Reproductive rights have become a signature issue for Harris, whose March visit to a Minnesota Planned Parenthood clinic was the first ever by a sitting president or vice president to an abortion provider. Since the beginning of the year, she's been on a reproductive freedoms tour across the country, hammering Republicans on an issue that has weighed them down in elections since the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision in 2022. "The former president is the architect of a healthcare crisis," Harris said in Minnesota last month, "and the extremists, well, they're not done." The Arizona law brings that warning into stark relief and is putting Republicans, who had hoped to make the state a referendum on Biden's border policies, on their heels. "I don't think there's a single Republican candidate in Arizona that was prepared for the fallout of that particular decision," Stan Barnes, a GOP consultant and former Arizona state senator, told The Hill, which is likely why their efforts to contain the backlash have been so clumsy. Even as they scrambled to distance themselves from the ban, Arizona Republicans in the state legislature this week blocked attempts by Democrats to undo it. "I don't see why we wouldn't move forward with our efforts," State Senator Anna Hernandez, a Democrat, said afterward. "Are Republicans just backpedaling when they realize they're on the losing side of a policy battle?" The answer, of course, is a resounding yes, but Democrats mustn't let their counterparts muddy the waters. Extreme politicians created this problem, and you better believe they're going to try to run away from it, as Pennsylvania Democrat Susan Wild told Axios this week. They publicly twist themselves into pretzels to distance themselves from court decisions that are completely in lockstep with the horrible and dangerous policies outlined by their party leadership. We save some time for a little best 11. Our first headline, nothing to see here, just a GOP politician leaving a loaded 9mm Glock in the bathroom of a Colorado state capitol. Don Wilson says he's sorry. This is published on the 12th. From likening gun control legislation to the Holocaust to posing for a Christmas card brandishing an actual machine gun, Republican politicians have a long history of saying and doing extremely stupid things when it comes to firearms. That tradition continued this week when a Colorado state representative left a loaded gun in the bathroom of the Capitol in Denver, i.e. his workplace. Yes, the state representative Don Wilson accidentally left his loaded 9mm Glock in the restroom of the State House on Tuesday, according to USA Today. Building staff found the unattended weapon at 9:30 p.m. and alerted the Colorado State Patrol, indicating the firearm was unattended for 23 minutes before being discovered by janitorial staff, CSP said in a statement. Wilson wrote in a statement posted online, "I want to be clear that I take full and complete accountability for the incident. I made a mistake and am very sorry. I take firearm safety very seriously. This is a humbling experience, and I will reaffirm my commitment to responsible handling procedures." According to USA Today, Wilson got his gun back after law enforcement concluded no criminal charges were pending following the incident. Not surprisingly, Wilson's Democratic colleagues noted that this whole thing was one of the many reasons stricter gun control legislation is necessary. "The consequences of leaving a firearm unattended in a public space could be very serious," State Representative Julie McCluskey said. "This should not have happened and cannot happen again, and this is why our caucus is pursuing legislation to prohibit carrying firearms in the Capitol." Our next headline, Trump wants a good-looking, election-denying, shorter-than-him running mate whom he doesn't have to see too much. This is also published on the 12th. At some point in the next several months, Donald Trump, having parted ways with his Veep, whom he almost got killed, is going to have to announce a 2024 running mate. Who is the lucky lady or lad going to be? No one, including the GOP presidential candidate himself, seems to know. The short list, a Trump advisor told the Washington Post, is growing, not shrinking, and the ex-president continues to come up with new names for consideration. But he definitely has some requirements that narrow the field of potential candidates. According to the Post, Trump, who is approaching his Veep stakes like he's on an episode of The Apprentice, ideally wants a person who is attractive, telegenic, not taller than Trump himself, committed to upholding the lie that the 2020 election was stolen, around but not a lot. Trump wants someone he sees in person but doesn't see too much, a winner in that they've won a previous election, not going to take over the MAGA movement from him. He would prefer that the Republican Party duke it out for his endorsement in 4 years. Perhaps black and or a woman, though neither is a must. People whose names have been thrown around, some of whom Trump himself has confirmed are being considered, reportedly include Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Alabama Senator Katie Britt, Tennessee Senator Bill Hagerty, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, Florida Representative Byron Donalds, New York Representative Elise Stefanik, and failed Arizona gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake. Lake, who is currently running for Senate, has never won a race, which is presumably a mark against her. Although it was reported last July that Trump had grown less enthusiastic about her because he found her to be a spotlight hound. According to the Post, Trump has questioned if Noem has too much baggage, and some of his top advisors were reportedly put off by Teethgate. For his part, Trump has claimed that his Veep pick won't have any impact at all on the race, and given the cult of personality that surrounds the ex-president, that could conceivably be true. Yet, according to a report from Puck, Trump has been increasingly concerned about the A word, i.e. abortion, and how a potential running mate could hurt or help him on the issue. To be clear, Trump isn't concerned about reproductive rights from, like, the standpoint of wanting people to be free to make their own choices about their own bodies. Rather, he's concerned about how abortion has been a losing issue for Republicans, and the Arizona Supreme Court's decision this week to uphold a Civil War-era law, effectively banning abortion one day after Trump said the matter should be decided by the states, may play a role in who receives the VP nod. Per Puck. Indeed, a source close to Trump told me that since landing on the states' rights position, he has explicitly changed his VP calculus, moving from his shortlist governors from states without exceptions for abortion in cases of rape or incest, or any state with a so-called heartbeat bill before 10 weeks. That eliminates South Dakota Governor and Best Teeth Award winner Kristi Noem. She has the most extreme positions, which is why some have never taken her seriously, said a source familiar with the former president's list. It's also curtains for Noam's neighbor, affable billionaire North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, as well as for Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the popular governor of Arkansas. It's a hard pitch, a Trump advisor told me, explaining why governors are dropping from VP consideration as Trump embraces a states' rights position. If you're his VP, you cannot be a distraction. The A-word issue isn't great news for Tim Scott either. Many in Trump's inner circle have been arguing that enlisting the party's only black senator would neutralize concerns among suburban swing state white women that Trump is racist. And on paper, Scott isn't all that different from every other Senate Republican who supports Lindsey Graham's proposed 15-week national abortion ban. But it's the way Scott came out of the gate during his failed presidential campaign, leaning hard into a draconian pro-life stance and calling a federal abortion ban a moral obligation, that has alarmed some Trump allies. When Tim announced for president, they kept asking him about abortion, and he gave a lot of shitty answers, said a source with knowledge of Trump's deliberations. As Puck notes, no Republican can truly take the abortion issue off the table for Trump, who handpicked the conservative justices who went on to nuke Roe and set the stage for Arizona's antebellum court ruling. But two names have reportedly arisen when it comes to candidates who might ameliorate the challenge: Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance. To be clear, neither man is a proponent of reproductive rights. Rubio co-sponsored Graham's national abortion ban bill, and Vance campaigned against the Ohio ballot measure to enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution. But Team Trump apparently believe Vance's flexible approach to ideology, red, lack of belief in anything, is as close a close match for Trump's own. As for Rubio, he has a long, well-documented history of flip-flopping on almost everything. We're going to finish up with the Proust questionnaire from the April issue of Vanity Fair, Bobby Brown, the movie mogul. Vanity Fair asks, what's your idea of perfect happiness? Being at our beach house with my family in the Bahamas. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Queen Elizabeth II, small but mighty and deeply caring. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Being anxious about the small stuff. On what occasions do you lie? Is that handbag new? What do you consider your greatest achievement? Of course, my three boys, but also launching a new makeup company at 63. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Business school. Which living person do you most admire? My husband, who always seems to have everything in control and is so consistent. What is your greatest fear? Safety of loved ones. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Lies. When and where were you happiest? At each of my son's weddings. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My neck. What is your favorite journey? Jones Road. What is your greatest extravagance? Vacations. What is your greatest regret? I don't have any. What word or phrase do you most overuse? That's so cool. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My husband, three sons, and granddaughter. Which talent would you most like to have? I'd love to be a great dancer. What is your current state of mind? Overwhelmed but grateful? If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I'd like to be more chill. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? They'd all live closer. What is your most treasured possession? My photographs. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Knowingly hurting others and having no remorse. Where would you like to live? Right where I live right now, but I've always wanted to get a London flat. What is your favorite occupation? Entrepreneur. What is your most marked characteristic? Naivete. What is your motto? I am me. This brings us to the end of our time here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you for tuning in. I invite you next week for another full hour of Vanity Fair. Thank you, and have a great week, everybody.